Is there any difference in the efficacy of treatments for type 2 diabetes based on age or sex?
Lifestyle interventions to prevent cognitive decline.
Does prehabilitation before surgery have any impact?
And putting diabetes mellitus into remission.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, with your permission, I'd like to turn first to the BMJ, this tantalizing prospect of can we put type 2 diabetes into remission?
Yep, and for the 422 million people worldwide that currently have type 2 diabetes mellitus, this will be really important information. We have a number of different medication approaches to type 2 diabetes, one of them being SGLT2 inhibitors. They've also been shown to help with weight loss by combining a very modest caloric restriction with an SGLT2 inhibitor. Dapagliflozin, can you actually put diabetes into remission? These investigators looked at 328 patients, all had type 2 diabetes of less than 6 years duration, 20 to 70 years of age. They tried to get them to decrease their diet by about 500 to 750 calories, either randomized them to placebo or again to the SGLT2 inhibitor. And then they followed them over a 12-month period. They tested their blood and they defined remission as if the hemoglobin A1C went to less than 6.5 and stayed that way for 2 months without any medications. Those that had the modest dietary restrictions alone, about 28% of them got into remissions. If you added the SGLT2 inhibitor, it went up to 44%. The addition of the medication also lowered their body weight more. It improved their insulin resistance, and it also improved their body fat, their systolic blood pressure, and other metabolic risk factors.
And let's talk about the side effects.
So it's interesting, Elizabeth, there were no significant differences between the two groups in the occurrence of adverse events. Keep in mind, it's a relatively small study. It's 328 patients. They all tolerated the medicine very well. No increase in side effects. Although it's a relatively new medication, and therefore it's a little bit more expensive, it's covered by most insurance plans because of its effectiveness in reducing weight, type 2 diabetes, and now not just treating it, but actually putting it into remission.
Again, I'm going to quip. Are we going to be finding these things in the water pretty soon? Let's turn to Gemma. Since we're talking about type 2 diabetes, this is an examination of whether there are age or sex differences in the efficacy of treatments, these newer treatments largely for type 2 diabetes. And it's a meta-analysis. You've already mentioned these SGLT2 inhibitors. There's also GLP-1 receptor agonists and DPP-4 inhibitors, these three classes of diabetes meds that have all been shown to really improve hemoglobin A1C. Two of them have been shown to reduce the risk of major adverse cardiovascular events in those people who do have type 2 diabetes. So what these investigators did was say, okay, what's the difference between these things with regard to those outcomes of hemoglobin A1C level and these MACEs, major adverse cardiovascular events? 310,000 almost participants with a report of the HbA1c and 168,000 plus who had reported MACEs. And also they had the information on what kind of an agent they were on. What they concluded was the relative reduction in MACEs with the use of the SGLT2 inhibitors was greater in older versus younger patients. The reduction in MACEs with the use of GLP-1 receptor agonists was less in older versus younger participants. There was no consistent evidence for sex and treatment interactions with the use of either the SGLT2 inhibitors or the GLP-1 receptor agonists. I think this is useful information in trying to determine if you have a patient with type 2 diabetes, how you're going to manage it among these three choices.
They're all three available, but only two of which have been shown to have cardioprotective effects. What we had presupposed was that anything that lowered the hemoglobin A1C would be beneficial, and the more you lowered it, the more beneficial it would be. Even though the SGLT2 inhibitors had smaller reductions in A1C, they were the ones that were most effective in the older population. So there's not a direct correlation. And furthermore, only two of the three showed cardioprotective effects. The DPP-4 inhibitors did not show cardioprotective effects, even though they were just as effective in lowering the A1C. There is some differences with regard to age. There does not appear to be any difference with regard to gender, and we can't use the A1C as a surrogate measure of how cardioprotective one or more of these agents would be.
And those are important outcomes, I think. They also note that for each trial, they looked at serious adverse events, and those included gastrointestinal, urinary tract infections, hypoglycemic episodes, amputations, and ketoacidosis. There was really notable difference in that.
The other thing that we should mention is that even though we talk about there may be a difference with regard to how cardioprotective these are with regard to age, is that they had very few people over the age of 80. And those are the individuals that are most susceptible to either having a cardiac event, having an adverse event with a medication, or having frailty and other comorbid conditions. So we actually need to extend this to older individuals.
Yeah, no doubt there's going to be plenty more coming on this one. So let's turn to your next one, and that's in Nature Medicine.
Lifestyle interventions to prevent cognitive decline. As we age, all of us experience cognitive decline. And ultimately, what we want to do is we want to prevent dementia. The global dementia prevalence is expected to triple from 55 million in 2020 to as many as 139 million over the next 20 years. There are many studies that show that the onset of cognitive decline or dementia has modifiable risk factors: education, physical activity, obesity, depression, excessive alcohol consumption, diabetes. Those are all addressable or preventable causes, at least 12 modifiable factors. So what these investigators did, they said, okay, can we devise an online risk intervention? It would be inexpensive, widely available, but assess where a person is, encourage them to set their goals, and then track them. Would that actually prevent cognitive decline? This is a single-blind, randomized controlled trial done in Australia in individuals aged 55 to 77, over 6,100 of these individuals. And they randomized them to performing different modules: physical activity, nutrition, cognitive activity and depression or anxiety, versus just giving them information alone. And they followed their cognitive function over the course of 3 years, giving fairly sophisticated cognitive tests. And what they realized is that that combination addressing all these things did result in better cognition in older adults over a 3 year period. Interestingly enough, most of the improvement came in the first year, and then after that, it remained relatively stable. They had four different interventions, and they can't isolate if there was one that was more effective than the others. So it's probably multiple lifestyle interventions. Even though they could assess cognitive function in sophisticated tests, it didn't assess whether it actually prevented dementia. And it's hard to determine whether a small, statistically significant difference on a cognitive test contributes to a different quality of life. Is there executive function? Is there decision making better? Is there anxiety, depression less as measured on a test? And how does that translate into regular life? That's going to require additional studies.
Indeed, and some additional really long-term studies with a lot of really rigorous follow-up. And we talk about those kinds of pie-in-the-sky studies a lot. Hideously expensive, hard to get people to participate over that kind of a lifetime. Gosh, when you have to institute these sorts of changes in order to have an impact on this hard outcome of the development of dementia, of multiple types, too, by the way.
Yeah, as you mentioned, people are really eager when they first start out and then decline. So at the end of the time, only about a third of them were doing all these things. There was clearly a better improvement in physical activity. There were more minutes spent in vigorous or moderate exercise. Their dietary habits got better. There was lower psychological distress. They could show that there were these changes, but you're right, they decline over time.
Our a priori hypothesis is very attractive and appears to be very practical and pragmatic. It would be great to see everyone institute that, and we'd see lots of impact on other chronic illnesses as well.
Yeah. And Elizabeth, I failed to mention there was a greater impact in younger individuals, which suggests that they should be started earlier. This is a very practical thing to do, and we probably ought to do it on a population basis.
Finally, remaining in the BMJ, this is a look at the relative efficacy of prehabilitation interventions and their components. And it's again a meta-analysis looking at these components of exercise, nutrition, cognitive intervention, and psychosocial interventions on critical outcomes of post-operative complications, including length of stay, health-related quality of life, and physical recovery for adults who have had surgery. They were able to identify just shy of 16,000 participants and 186 unique randomized controlled trials to consider here. only exercise and nutrition in combination was able to reduce the number of days that somebody was in the hospital and had a moderate certainty of evidence. Virtually all the other interventions and their combinations had low or very low certainty of evidence in their identification. While they all seemed to actually show a benefit to folks, they weren't able to say, yep, this was a study that was without bias or it was randomized properly or whatever else they were using to assess it. It's like apple pie and motherhood. We can advocate for this, but we can only advocate for it based on a gestalt about it, not really on the evidence.
Yeah, I mean, the evidence is low quality and there's a lot of bias. They do know that there is some consistency, even though each of the individual studies is imperfect in many ways. In aggregate, it showed that exercise, probably nutrition as well, were very important prehabilitation measures to decrease complications and decrease length of stay in the hospital. For elective surgeries, doing exercise and proper nutrition beforehand sounds like it's a really good thing.
I do want to note that the authors say that the focus of this review was directly informed by three patients and 10 knowledge user partners in order to examine all this. And I think that's a pretty low end. I'm wondering about what bias is inherent in this just as a result of who was doing the study.
Doing what's called a network analysis, all we're asking these individuals to do is to display the evidence in a way that is consistent across the studies, and then let the studies speak for themselves. And they apply specific criteria to determine whether there's low, medium, or high certainty that the results that the authors claim are supported by the evidence. They look at things like how were people enrolled, how were they followed up, what are the endpoints, were they objective or subjective endpoints, and then looking at the totality of data. So I'm less concerned about the people that were pulling the data and more concerned about the data that they were actually looking at.
Right. I don't want to discourage anybody who wants to take on these kinds of strategies when they're going to be having an elective procedure. They do make sense to me, and they seem that they would improve the outcomes. I will say that the authors conclude that the effects of exercise, nutrition, plus psychosocial and exercise, plus nutrition reached statistical significance in their analysis. So it seems like all three of those strategies would be well worth attempting.
Yeah, three of our studies talked about lifestyle interventions and the changes. So let's get on these things.
I agree. On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.